In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
We'll talk some movies and more. Alan Adams joining us as he does every Monday. Hello there, Alan.
Hello there, sir. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. And hey, I'm excited to talk movies, but much bigger and more exciting news, and that's a clean bill of health for Stella. That is awesome.
Yeah, right. We had talked a little bit about it back when we were doing the treatments for her situation, and so it was we were set up to do her 3-month check-in this last Friday, and we were very happy to find out that everything looks good. The doctor was very pleased with the progress that she's made, and everyone feels very very strongly that she's going to do all right going forward. So we'll continue to knock wood and try to be optimistic. But as of right now, it's looking really nice. So we appreciate the well wishes.
Who's a good girl?
She is.
Yeah. How was your weekend?
Yeah. It was good, actually. It's funny because my mom and Sheridan's mom had birthdays on either side of the weekend, last Thursday, and Sheridan's mom is this week. And so we basically planned so we could do sort of get-togethers on Saturday and Sunday. And all parents involved are fully vaccinated and past the 2-week window, and my lovely bride actually has passed through that window as well. And so it was nice to be able to go and feel secure and safe and celebrate with one another and almost feel normal. Like, it's still weird, and it's probably going to be weird for the foreseeable future, but it was just really nice to be reminded of how much joy can be brought from being with one another. And as long as people keep doing the right thing and trusting in the powers that be, I think we'll be able to keep moving in that direction. It certainly seems like we're doing as well at that in this neck of the woods as anywhere. Hopefully that trend continues.
That's awesome. Well, happy birthday to both of them. And tell your mom I can't wait till we can do an improv show and see her there.
Right. Like, that's something that I, mom was always one of, if not the biggest fan of the focus group. And so it'll be nice to sort of get back to that.
All right, let's talk movies. You saw a whole passel of them. Where should we begin?
Yeah, I did see a bunch. Let's start with this movie called Best Summer Ever. And I acknowledge we can try as hard as we want to be objective when we consume a piece of art, whether it's a movie or a book or a TV show or an album, what have you. All criticism is subjective, like, because it all boils down to what one person thinks or feels about a piece of art. That said, sometimes, doesn't happen often, but sometimes something comes along where it kind of transcends that sort of subjective, objective struggle. Like, you experience something that basically establishes its value simply through being what it is. Like, you can try to attach judgments or measurements, but its fundamental power is basically comes through in the fact, just by the mere fact of its existence. And that's kind of what Best Summer Ever is. So it's an original musical. It's directed by two people, Michael Parks Randa and Lauren Spitelli. The two of them co-wrote the script along with a handful of other people. And it's a project from a group called Zeno Mountain Farm. It's a camp in Vermont whose mission is to basically immerse people, both disabled and non-disabled, in the arts. And so what this movie is, it's the most inclusive film I've ever seen. Like, it's unique in that inclusivity isn't like, that's not what the movie's about. Like, it's not about like, oh, we're all the same and we're all together and all that stuff. It just is. Like, it just has people, both able-bodied folks and people with varying disabilities just sharing the screen and operating under those auspices, and that's it. So you have this wonderful, joyful project, sweet, good-hearted, and it's a surprisingly clever sort of deconstruction of the sort of teen musical trope, with references, like it's very winking, very self-referential, with nods to stuff like Grease and High School Musical and Footloose and all these little winks and nods, but it has some wonderful original music. And one of the more interesting on-screen romances that I think you're going to see, because you've got a young man named Tony, played by Ricky Alexander Wilson, who has spent his summer at dance camp chasing his passion. And in the course of that time, he's fallen for a young lady named Sage, played by Shannon DeVito, who's a fellow camper. They've had this wonderful time, but the fall is coming, and they have to go their separate ways. Tony tells her he's going back to New York City, and she gets ready to hit the road with her two moms, who are also traveling cannabis farmers, because it's that kind of movie. but it turns out Tony wasn't being truthful about his post-camp plan. He headed home, but it wasn't New York City. He heads to his small Midwestern hometown, where he's the star of the football team. The star kicker of the football team. Like, again, like it's so like delightful. And he's the star. Like, he's apparently the only hope for this team to break their streak of 25 years of futility in the annual homecoming matchup. So he has all this pressure on him. But he's conflicted. He loves football, but he also loves to dance. And it's turning out that reconciling the two isn't that easy, especially since he lives with his coach, who took him in after the tragic passing of his parents. And so the pressure's on from the moment school starts. And it's not just the football, because the head cheerleader, Beth, is bound and determined to be homecoming queen, and she thinks that having Tony to help her will do the trick. And the quarterback of the team, this kid Cody, resents the fact that the kicker is the star and wants the spotlight to himself. But then, wouldn't you know it, circumstances lead to Sage and her family stranded in Tony's town, so she has to go to public school for the first time, and that's when she learns that Tony's deception, that's sort of revealed. Her presence leads him to rethink his priorities and wonder if maybe he can be just more than a football player. But, Beth's not going to let Sage's appearance derail her plans, so she and Cody team up in an effort to ensure that they both get what they want at the expense of Sage and Tony. And again, look, a lot of this probably sounds pretty familiar, and like I said, it's intentional. One of the best things about the movie is its clear adoration for the teen musical stories that came before. But, I mean, like, all the High School Musical stuff is there, and there's some more subtle stuff. There's a literal, like, dance in a barn scene that's straight out of Footloose. At one point, a very confused mascot quotes Grease. Like, this is a movie that's willing to have a lot of fun with those inspirations. And again, when you embrace formula like that, it can be an issue. But the commitment to the bit is so thorough and so sincere that it absolutely works. Now, and I know I've mentioned a couple of times the inclusive nature of this movie. And I need to be clear. Like, this is not inclusive in the sort of well-meaning but kind of condescending, very special episode manner that we get so often. Like, it just literally treats everyone the same. It sounds so basic, but how often do we see films or TV shows where a disabled person is, like, their sole character trait is that disability? There's none of that here. Like, everyone is engaged with on the same fundamental level. And it's just so lovely. Like, I'm as guilty of it as anyone. So many of us allow our cynicism about the world to interfere with our enjoyment of it. And, this movie is a lot of things, but cynical ain't one of them. There's a real glow to the film, and it just makes it impossible to watch with anything other than a smile on your face. And look, the performers vary significantly in terms of their experience, but they're all pinning the needle as far as enthusiasm is concerned. And that's what a movie like this needs. Like, if they buy in, we'll buy in. And they buy in. The leads are great. Supporting cast is great. But everybody's fun. I mean, there are a couple of famous faces that pop up in a couple of cameos. Like Maggie Gyllenhaal and Peter Sarsgaard are in this movie for a minute. Benjamin Bratt and his real-life daughter, Sophia, show up. But, I mean, basically, it just... I know, it's just unlike anything I've seen before. Like, it's this wonderful celebration of teen musicals, and it's sweet and funny. The songs are great, and the message is really pure and powerful. Like, it's, again, it's just a movie experience that I'm really, really glad that I had.
All right, that's the story on Best Summer Ever. What's up next?
Let's talk about, let's just get it out of the way. Let's talk about Tom Clancy's Without Remorse. This is the last time I'm going to refer to it as Tom Clancy's Without Remorse, because you know what? Tom Clancy has suffered enough. Look, I've never read a Tom Clancy book. Like, I've seen some adaptations, and I have a general sense of the sort of base airport fiction with militaristic themes vibe, but I don't have a deep familiarity. But again, it's a matter of taste. Like, the dude topped the bestseller list 17 times, I think. Like, his overall sales figures are in the hundreds of millions. So, I mean, what do I know? But I have to imagine that this new adaptation, again, titled Tom Clancy's Without Remorse, doesn't necessarily live up to the man's legacy, even though his name is literally in the title. It's directed by a guy named Stefano Salima, co-written by Taylor Sheridan and Will Staples. And it's an Amazon Studios original, so it's streaming on Amazon Prime Video as we speak. Honestly, Rich, it's a bit of a mess. It's convoluted. The characters don't really have any motivation to speak of. They're just sort of careening from set piece to set piece. There's not a whole lot of rhyme or reason along the way. Now, granted, you've got Michael B. Jordan in the lead, which certainly helps to compensate for the more egregious flaws. But the truth is, I mean, he's incredibly talented, but he's just one guy. And even with all the muscles and all the talent, he can't lift this film out of the just sort of chaotic morass it's in. He's definitely an action star, but I mean, sometimes even a star shine can't kind of hide the sort of ragged edges of a project. So he stars as Senior Chief John Kelly, elite U.S. Navy SEAL. He and his team go on a mission to Syria to rescue a CIA operative that's been taken hostage by ISIS forces. But when they go through the extraction, it becomes clear that the captors are not ISIS, but rather Russian military. And when John Kelly protests after the fact, he's kind of shut down by the CIA handler in the situation, played by Jamie Bell. So flash forward to a few months later, he's on the verge of retiring from active duty, going into private security. He's got a wife and a baby on the way. Like, he's really getting ready to settle into civilian life. But it all changes when members of his extraction team from that mission start getting picked off one by one. And this includes an attempt on his life, an attempt that leaves him badly injured, but ultimately results in the death of his wife and the loss of his unborn child. So, from there, he decides to track down the one man who was part of the raid on his home that got away. He gets some reluctant help from the aforementioned CIA operative, as well as the Secretary of Defense, played by Guy Pearce. He gets intel that moves him towards his goal, a goal that he will not stop to achieve, regardless of, you know, how many fights he winds up. He goes everywhere from prison to foreign countries and all this stuff. But as often is the case in these sorts of films, there are other forces at work, Rich, and these forces have their own reasons for wanting him to succeed in his mission and fail to return from it. Look, I get into the weeds regarding the plot of this movie, but the truth is, like, so many of the particulars don't make any sense. Like, a lot of significant action takes place without any indication being given of why anything is happening. Like, look, I don't need my hand held when I'm watching an action movie, but, I mean, you got to meet me halfway. Like, I don't need intricate, delicate plotting, but some indication of motivation would be kind of nice. But there's none of it. From the moment the bullets start flying at the top of the movie to the honestly, like, genuinely absurd, like, MCU-style mid-credits cutscene that is clearly intended to set up a sequel, I can't imagine that. I can't imagine anyone wants a sequel to this movie, but we're never really given any real notion of why anyone is doing what they're doing. Like, we get some stock, like, jingoistic speeches tossed out here and there, and you know, the occasional sort of villainous doing it for your own good boilerplate, but it's all rote and kind of disconnected from what we're actually experiencing. Like, the action stuff is solid, a bit generic, but it's fine. But set pieces are what drive movies like this. And there are a couple of good ones, but there aren't any great ones. And I mean, honestly, like, having action that's pretty good is far from enough to make a confusing muddle like this one work. Look, landing an A-lister like Michael B. Jordan is a coup, especially considering the project was basically in development hell from the moment the book came out, which was almost 30 years ago. He's a talented actor. He has action chops. Like, I mean, there are only a handful of dudes out there who could pull it off. He's very good. I just wish the movie around him matched his efforts. And the rest of the cast never really gets any runway as far as developing characters or elevating the story. So, I mean, they go pretty hard, but they can only do so much. So, basically, it boils down to this. Like, it's really, Without Remorse is very generic action fare. Like, imagine the movie equivalent of ordering off a laminated menu, and you're close.
All right. So much for Without Remorse. What's next?
So I saw a really sweet, small little movie called The Outside Story that it's available on video on demand. And it's the sort of movie that I might not have seen under other circumstances. Like, it's not the sort of movie that's gonna open in 2,000 theaters. Like, it's a very quiet, small sort of film, but it's really well done. Like, it's the sort of thing that it's driven by very thoughtful, grounded performances. You know, a story of what it means to be a part of the world and what happens when we sort of spend too much time trying to separate ourselves from our surroundings. And how that can impact the way our sort of lives unfold. So we've got this guy, Charles, his name, played by Brian Tyree Henry, who's great in this. He's a video editor living in New York City. He's in the immediate aftermath of a breakup. His girlfriend, Isha, played by Sonequa Martin-Green, cheated on him and is in the process of moving out. He's also on a work deadline because his job, and it's fascinating because I'm sure this actually is a job, although I'd never really thought about it before. His job is crafting video memorials for Turner Classic Movies. So whenever a noted performer passes, they're ready to put a video memorial up on the channel as soon as possible. So that's his gig, and there's a noted actor who is currently on his deathbed, and so he has to work on this memorial video to have it ready to go. So he's the kind of guy who spends a lot of time just in his apartment, a very insular, sort of introverted kind of guy. He's not interested in experiencing the world around him to any real extent. Like, you know, orders in food a lot, just the whole shebang. And so this one time, he's ordered delivery, but he's short on cash for the tip. He returns to his apartment, finds a few bucks, and chases down the delivery guy to make it right. But that second time when he left the apartment, he forgot his keys. So he's locked out. His phone's running out of juice, doesn't have any money. He's not even wearing shoes. And so basically, one of the longest days of his life is basically beginning. Like, this is a person who doesn't want to interact with the world. You know, and his girlfriend at first was sort of a willing partner in that kind of isolation. But her desire to engage with the outside was one of the issues, I think, that pushes them apart. So he's basically forced to interact with other people, his neighbors and the like. And it's an idea that's foreign and frightening to him, but he has to. Like, he has encounters with one neighbor named Andre, the guy who lives on the fourth floor, who grows increasingly exasperated every time Charles buzzes to get let in, because all Andre wants to do is engage in sexy times with the cheerful Icelandic couple who randomly showed up at his house. He also meets Elena, a young lady who lives directly above him, who is a very talented pianist. And it's not just his building either. He meets the recently widowed Sarah, who lives in the building next door. He helps a pregnant lady from down the street put some chalk signage on the sidewalk for her stoop sale. He even starts sort of smoothing over what is initially an antagonistic relationship with the local parking cop. And all the while, he's receiving increasingly frantic texts from his boss about the memorial video, but he can't get into his apartment and finish, and he can't seem to stop talking about his ex-girlfriend and his feelings about all that, even as pretty much everyone is like, well, maybe you want to do a little bit more examination of the situation and really start thinking about stuff. And that's kind of it. Like, it's this wonderful, small, charming story about what happens when we're forced out of our comfort zones. Like, he's literally locked out of his safe space, so he has no choice but to venture out into a world that he's really, long expressed no interest in exploring. But as he spends more time engaging with the people near him, like, and these are people to whom he's been in close physical proximity for years but has never engaged with, like, he starts to sort of accept the idea that maybe other people do have a little something to offer. It's a very insular film, which is wonderful. With a couple of exceptions, the entire thing takes place on basically his block, like, and the majority of that is in front of or in his building. And so that smallness is this wonderful representation of his own worldview. Like, in this huge and vibrant city, he's limited his experience to just a tiny slice. And so by allowing his outlook to be colored by these sort of personal and professional setbacks, he's isolated himself. He lives in a world where no one's allowed in, no matter how close they might be. And it's a phenomenal performance from Brian Tyree Henry. Like, he's been amazing in a number of prominent supporting roles over the last few years, but this is his first real, like, lead, and it's a wonderful performance. Like, it's layered, it's very complex. You know, so much of this guy's personality could be unlikable, but thanks to Henry's sort of nuances and just a wonderful charisma, like, he's shaped into a figure who we can't help but root for. I mean, it's great work. Supporting cast is great. Like, you know, it's the sort of movie that that I hope people will seek out more. This wonderful, quiet, under the radar kind of work that is well and thoughtfully made. It's a breakout turn from Henry. Just a wonderful look at the importance of not just observing the world, but being a part of it.
All right. And finally, Alan tells us about The Mitchells versus The Machines.
Yeah, man. I like it when a movie surprises me. I don't really care what kind of surprise, whether it's a narrative surprise or an aesthetic surprise, maybe a thematic surprise. I just dig it when the movie becomes something different than what I anticipated. And when it's a kid's movie on top of that, I mean, let's go. And that's what this movie is. Like, it's the latest one from the folks at Sony Animation. It's directed by first-time feature directors Mike Rianda and Jeff Rowe from a script that the two co-wrote. It's a computer-generated animated film that brings together two fairly disparate concepts in a way that shouldn't work, but does. Basically, what we have here is a movie that is a dysfunctional family road trip comedy and a dystopian battle against the machine uprising.
Wow.
Like I said, it shouldn't work, but it manages to maintain this wonderful sense of goofball whimsy while also conveying genuine tension regarding the sort of apocalyptic events that are going on around them. Like, it's heartfelt, it's hilarious, and it really balances those seemingly incongruous parts with a plum. So the basic gist is Katie Mitchell, voiced by Abby Jacobson, is a high school student in Michigan. She's an outcast, her peers think she's weird, but she has these big dreams of going to film school in California. Her mom is endlessly supportive, voiced by Maya Rudolph. Her dad, however, she and her dad don't really see eye to eye. Her dad's Rick, voiced by Danny McBride. He's a nature-loving pragmatist who doesn't really understand computers and is pretty sure this whole internet thing is kind of a fad. So when she gets into film school, tensions between the two of them boil over into a fight, and Rick opts to resolve the conflict by canceling Katie's plane tickets and planning a family road trip to drive his mortified daughter to college. Meanwhile, in Silicon Valley, we've got a tech mogul named Mark Bowman, voiced by Eric Andre, who is the inventor of the nigh ubiquitous digital assistant called Pal, voiced by, Academy Award winner Olivia Colman.
Ooh.
And he's launching a new product. It's a series of smart robots intended to become part of everyday life. He sort of believes that his previous offerings, including Pal, have become obsolete. Here's the thing, Rich. Never betray an artificial intelligence. particularly one that has access to pretty much everything. So, as you know, you might expect, the robots go rogue and immediately fly off all over the globe, rounding up every human that they could find. Due to a spate of frankly hilarious ineptitude, the Mitchell family manages to avoid the first sweep and even wind up bonding with a pair of defective and thus fairly genial robots named Eric, voiced by Beck Bennett, and Deborah Bot 5000, voiced by Fred Armisen. So when Katie figures out a possible way to stop the robot, save the world, she decides that she'll do whatever it takes, even if that means reconnecting with her dad along the way. Again, I can't stress enough, this sort of blend of genre and tone should not click. Like, you've got the wacky road trip shenanigans of this oddball family trying and failing to behave normally. And on the other, you have the singularity in which an artificial intelligence is using robots to essentially take over the world. But the movie really moves effortlessly from one to the other. Like, the wackiness has moments of seriousness, the bleakness has moments of levity. There's an unwavering commitment to ridiculous sight gags and running jokes, and it just, not only does it work, it works well. Look, does this movie find ways to obliquely approach the social and societal consequences of over-reliance on technology? Sure. Does it address the notion that being different isn't a bad thing, and that we can almost always find points of connection between us, particularly if we love each other? Sure, that too. Like, I was so unprepared for how well this was going to work together. Like, the cast is great. Like, the voice work, again, is across the board excellent. Jacobson's great. Danny McBride subverts his usual coarseness in a fun way. Rudolph shines throughout, but she really crushes it in the third act. Beck Bennett, Fred Armisen are always fun. And again, I think it's fair to say that this is easily the best animated film to ever feature an Academy Award winning actress as the voice of a digital assistant. Look, Olivia Colman is very obviously having an incredibly good time, in this movie. So basically it boils down to this. This movie was much more than I expected it to be. Like, a smart, sweet, and very funny sort of genre mashup that kind of exceeds the sum of its parts. Like, it's got a great cast, an engaging aesthetic, the animation is wonderful, and the narrative is really interesting and dynamic. Like, all in all, a pleasant surprise, and frankly, just a heck of a good time.
Well, there. Interesting choices abound this week. Thank you, as always, Alan.
Hey, my pleasure, man.
Let's get together again Wednesday if you've got time.
Sounds good to me.
All right, we'll see you then. Alan Adams of The Main Edge on Downtown.